Thanks a ton. It's a privilege to be back at Spats. I certainly love Texas. I brought my family this year, and I've got a 16-year-old son who's working through South Padre Island right now as we speak for the first time, so we'll see how that turns out for us tonight. I'm here to talk about overtraining and the risk management in the multi-sport athlete. This is a topic that's been near and dear to my heart for a while, and actually for several years I was kind of the evangelist around the community that I live in about making sure that our athletes, especially our adolescent athletes, were getting enough rest and recovery time, because I was the guy who was always observing the fact that, listening at least to my friends and colleagues, always talking about how often they had to run to 3 or 4 practices a day for the same kid. They're dropping them off for youth soccer in the morning, and then there's league basketball, AAU this, soccer, and running around all the time. And then I've got my own set of teenagers. They just magically appeared on my door one day, and all of a sudden realized that it wasn't so easy to keep them out of everything that they wanted to be involved in. So I kind of really began to investigate this myself and get into it. So we'll talk a little bit about overtraining. I have really two big objectives for us this morning, and overarching objectives. One is just to talk about overtraining, what it is, some of the theories behind the pathophysiology of overtraining that are out there, because believe it or not, to date, with all the research and everything that we have, we really have no idea why athletes are overtrained, where overtraining comes from, the etiology of that. So we'll talk about some different theories surrounding that, and then we'll talk about this concept of the multi-sport athlete, and is this really a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What are some of the pros and cons of being a multi-sport athlete? So without any further ado, we'll move on. Some of the evidence, and again, this will be available for you. These articles will be available for you. But just a little background. Instead of doing a long bibliography at the end, I thought I'd just point out a few of the salient articles that were used to put this together and is being used right now. Overtraining syndrome in the adolescent athlete, a current clinical practice. It's kind of a quasi-meta-analysis. Based on the European Sports Science Society, and some of the recommendations that they have put forth for that is one of the major sources of our talk this morning. Overtraining Syndrome, a Practical Guide, which is something the American College of Sports Medicine helped put together, which is also kind of, again, a meta-analysis, systematic review of the different theories and things with overtraining syndrome. Journal article from the Journal of Athletic Training, a review of overtraining syndrome, recognizing the signs and symptoms that we can look into, and then an article on the multi-sport athlete and exactly what the multi-sport athlete, multi-seasonal athlete, the stresses that they are actually kind of involved in and some of the risks and red flags with that, as well as some of the benefits, because it's not purely a risk to be a multi-sport athlete. There's actually quite a few benefits to that. So that's just a little bit, just so you know where we're coming from. And these articles will be available to you. I'd like to start with some key definitions, just so we all are on the same page with what exactly we're talking about. So we'll talk first about functional overreaching. And when we talk about overtraining syndrome, you have to talk about at least these three key terms: the functional overreaching, non-functional overreaching, and overtraining syndrome itself. Now, we're all familiar with the concept of overload, and this is where this is based. So functional overreaching is actually a good thing. This is what we're going for when we design our strength and conditioning programs, when we design periodization programs, when we are trying to improve performance. It is the functional overreaching that is our goal. And this is intense training that results in a temporary decline in performance. That temporary decline in performance we know as fatigue. Okay, an athlete goes out, they train, they go through their practice, they go through whatever routine or regimen they are expected to by their coaches. They feel a little bit of fatigue, they feel tired, glycogen depletion, all those kinds of things occur. They get tired, they rest overnight, they reload carbohydrates or whatever else that they might need, and they're pretty much recovered in a day or two to be able to repeat it again. And when they are in that recovery phase is when they develop any of the characteristics that we're looking for, the training response. So typically, this decline in performance is only a day or two, and it results in enhanced performance. And this is, again, this is what we're going for. This is what we're trying to control. The second definition is now where we get into some a little bit more risky behavior. And this is non-functional overreaching. Non-functional overreaching is an accumulation of training, and here's the key, and non-training stress, resulting in short-term decrements of performance or maladaption, which takes several days to weeks to recover from. Now, I'll put a slide here in a moment about some of the key differences between the two, but you can tell I've already highlighted one for you. One of the things that tends to be the largest contributor to non-functional overreaching is the fact that so many of us, our coaches, our athletes, our parents, tend to forget the other stressors other than the physiologic stress of the actual activity that they're going through, the weightlifting, the running, the conditioning, whatever that might be. We know that that's a stressor, but we tend to forget the cumulative effect of the other stressors. So what are these other stressors we're talking about? Especially in the adolescent athlete, in the volatile ages of prepubescent ages, puberty, et cetera, their body is going through additional physiological changes. Their psychosocial, their social world is going through dramatic and rapid changes and alterations with girlfriends, boyfriends, parental stress, learning the driver's ed, for example, exams in school that now are becoming more significant in terms of their participation, because now grades matter. It's no longer rec ball where they can just show up and play. Now they have to maintain a certain GPA to be eligible. That's added stress. Things can be going on at home. There could be a move. There could be their mom and dad could be going through some kind of stress themselves, financial stress. All of these things have a cumulative effect that really add up and take a toll on the physiology of a performing athlete. So that's the non-training stress. And just about all the research you'll read from 2010 on up to current date talks about how important it is and necessary it is that we do not neglect, forget the cumulative stress of this non-athletic or non-sport stress that's added and causes a lot of our athletes to fall into this non-functional overreaching. The third definition is overtraining syndrome itself, and this is a simple definition, and it is an accumulation of training with long-term decrements in performance, and it may take months to years to recover. In some cases, it's a lifetime. So overtraining syndrome is a very serious diagnosis. It's a diagnosis of exclusion, which means we only know you have it, or we diagnose it until you already have it. So there's really no way to predict exactly who's going to get it or when. We have to rule out several other things first. So overtraining syndrome is identical to non-functional overtraining, with the only difference being the loss of performance, how long that takes, a decline in performance. Again, with non-functional overreaching, it's usually months, weeks to months, and weeks is defined 21 days or more. So we're talking 3 weeks or higher. If it's 21 days or less, it falls into a different category. 21 days or higher, it falls into that non-functional. If it exceeds that, then you're talking about overtraining syndrome. And then our final definition is the multi-sport athlete, and that's pretty self-evident, but just for the sake of having a good definition, athletes absent of an off-season, off-season training cycle, when there's not proper periodization going on and where training cycles overlap with ongoing sports. Just the example of my week last week is I wake up at 5 a.m. to take my son to football conditioning, which is 3 hours long, and it's pretty intense, as you all are, I'm sure, are very well aware. 3 hours of football training in the morning, home by 9 a.m. Then he has to do, of course, his chores around the house, which includes, mowing the lawn and those kinds of things. And after that, and then we take him. Then he has doubleheader baseball games in the middle of the day, where he plays two baseball games all day, and then goes home and usually wants to run and do some workout with some of the special kids on the football team who are trying to get brownie points with the coach and do a little extra working out. So that's his day. That's a lot of activity all day long, and especially even in Ohio, it does get pretty hot in August, July, August right now. So it's still, it's 90 degrees outside, and it's the humidity, it's hot. They're going all day, starting early in the morning. Of course, his idea of a great breakfast is the new power bar, the protein bar that's being advertised that he sees on TV. So that's his idea of what a good breakfast is, too. So we have to be vigilant about this, in addition to driver's ed and all the other things that he just started doing. So that's the multi-sport athlete. when our training cycles overlap with ongoing sports, and we really don't see an off season. And that's what we're talking about here. So these are the key definitions for us to look at, and let's now just start with some other synonyms for overtraining syndromes, just so you get an idea of what athletes and physicians are talking about. This is a list that's called from the literature of different physicians and what they call and how they use the same definition: staleness, burnout, chronic fatigue, failure adaptation, training stress syndrome, and then this bottom one is actually the most commonly used synonym, and that's unexplained under-recovery syndrome, and that is what they use in the UK to describe overtraining syndrome. And they actually like it because it's takes the blame off the coaches. That's exactly what the paper, the European paper I referenced first, talks about. They like to use that because it's actually more descriptive of what's going on. Unexplained under-recovery syndrome. So these are a couple of the words that you'll see being used. Key differences between functional overreaching, non-functional overreaching, and overtraining syndromes, just so you see. The first one is the outcome. In functional overreaching, the outcome is improved performance. In non-functional overreaching, the ultimate outcome is a decline in performance. That's the only way we know to tell the difference. Okay? A lot of other things being equal, at the end of the day, you look at, was performance increased or was performance decreased? If performance continues to increase and gains are being made, we can say with certainty, well, they're not in non-functional overreaching. When we start seeing that decline in performance, however, or a rash of injuries, especially the insidious onset injuries, then we're now teetering on this non-functional overreaching, and that should be the very first red flag that you have waving in your head. All right, this athlete's been training hard, they're starting to get a rash of injuries, or their times aren't getting any better, they kind of reached this plateau, maybe we need to back off a bit. The problem is this, and you've experienced this every bit as much as I have with the years that I've worked with track and field athletes, for example, the second you start thinking about non-functional overreaching as a possibility, we start to see, all right, well, improvements aren't being made, times aren't being improved. The first thing we do, our reflexive response across the board, from the parents, from the athletes, from the coaches, from everybody, is, well, we just need to pick up the intensity. So we're just, obviously, we're stale, we're hitting a plateau, so we need to mix things up. Let's do some interval, let's do something else, and we throw some caveat or some change in the regimen that increases the intensity, increases the frequency, changes the type somehow, and instead of doing what we should do, which is back off and rest, we actually do the exact opposite and increase. And that pushes us deeper into that non-functional overreaching, getting us dangerously close to the possibility of overtraining. And that's where I would say our biggest red flag is. And if there was any one single take-home message from my talk this morning, that would be what I hope you would walk away with. The understanding is, as soon as we start to see the performance decrease, rashes of insidious onset types of injuries, that we need to think non-functional overreaching as a possibility. And instead of saying, all right, letting the coaches increase, let's kind of back off a little bit. And then the differences between non-functional and overtraining syndrome, which I alluded to already, is the time to recovery. And that's really the biggest difference there, where it's going to take days and weeks for non-functional, up to years for overtraining syndromes in some instances. So any thoughts or questions about that now? I know I'm always going to come up, so it's okay. So let's go through these now. 7 theories of overtraining syndrome. This is the pathophysiology. Now, I just want you to know we're going to take 15 minutes to do these 7 theories. These are in-depth theories. I brought a little lit review panel with me in case somebody wanted to see some. But each one of these theories comes with a file folder of evidence and research and literature, etc. You're going to get a snippet paragraph, even shorter than a Reader's Digest version, of each one of these 7 theories that contribute to overtraining syndrome. I will just kind of let the cat out of the bag right now. As you can imagine, with 7 theories, not any one single theory is being accepted universally as the theory. Different researchers, different scholars, based on their research and background, each purport these as different. When you read the synthesized articles on it, they pretty much come to the consensus, say, listen, it's probably a combination of all seven of these in different doses that contribute to overtraining syndrome. So we'll start with number one, work through. And I'll tell you this right out of the bag, right off the bat, is number seven, cytokine hypothesis, is the one that has the most merit and is being looked at the most serious today by our scholars. So I saved that one for last. Okay. So theory number one, autonomic nervous system imbalance. This represents an imbalance between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems. Basically, it's also referred to as parasympathetic dominance. This theory says that when an athlete begins to demonstrate stress, metabolic and physiologic stress, the parasympathetic system kind of kicks into high gear and causes the athlete's sympathetic system to decrease in their involvement. If you can remember back to your days in physiology, the sympathetic prepares the body for that fight or flight kind of process. It's that reactionary adrenaline kick, where parasympathetic is what keeps us calm, helps us balance out rest. So basically, in overtrained athletes, you have a decrease in what's called heart rate variability. And when we wake up in the morning, when the parasympathetic system is higher, usually the sympathetic system is higher, when we wake up in the morning after rest, the parasympathetic system just stays in high gear. And as a result of that, we try to see that decrease in performance. The athlete feels sluggish, they can't really get themselves going, and that is the autonomic nervous system imbalance. And it's seen when patients who have overtraining syndrome, and accounts for some of the symptoms, but again, not all of the symptoms. The second theory is oxidative stress theory. Now, normally oxidative stress in small doses, again, is needed to help regulate cellular repair. Pathologic oxidative stress, however, leads to inflammation, muscle damage, muscle soreness, muscle fatigue, which obviously has a negative impact on performance. This oxidative stress actually causes damage to the mitochondria and protein synthesis, even our DNA replication, and makes one more susceptible, once you have that, to oxidative stress, and again is believed to inhibit performance. However, it is not seen as a precursor. So what that means is when somebody, you only see this in someone who already has overtraining syndrome. So it's not so much a predictive as much as this is what maybe keeps the athlete in that months to years of recovery. So once they have it, this becomes a problem and it keeps them in that long state of recovery because their body just can't recover. The third theory is glycogen depletion, and this is the weakest of all seven theories, and just so you know, but I just have to throw it out there. Glycogen depletion, obviously you are probably just as familiar with everybody in the room. When you exercise at high intensities and long frequencies, you deplete your body of glycogen, and that depletion of glycogen obviously has an impact on performance. So I won't spend too much time with that. That decrease in glycogen does affect the neurotransmitters somewhat involved in fatigue, so you get a decrease in performance. The trouble with this is there's plenty of people who are not glycogen depleted who experience overtraining syndrome, and typically those who do experience the decreases in performance associated with exercise, when they do take glycogen, it increases recovery time. So that's why that is one of the weaker ones, but it is an idea out there. Theory number four is the central fatigue theory. And this overtraining, one of the things that I didn't mention in the definitions that I suppose is appropriate to point out now is when we talk about overtraining, it typically includes mood disturbances, alterations in attitude, alterations in sleep-wake cycles, for example. So it will usually always, is that, can I say that? It very often includes mood disturbances, sleep disturbances, depression, discouragement, okay, usually always involves that. And this is part of where the central fatigue hypothesis is proposed in this. This proposes that the central nervous system is not providing enough drive to recruiting muscles. There are reports that central fatigue results from the numerous physiological changes that an athlete goes through when they go through a training cycle, including brain levels of tryptophan, decreased branched chain amino acids, increased serotonin, which is tied to the tryptophan, in the brain. So basically, this really is one of the big theories purported to contribute to that mood, that lackluster kind of engagement that an athlete will typically experience when they have overtraining syndrome. And that is, again, the central fatigue hypothesis. It is also one of the ones that's getting a lot of attention these days in particular. Theory number five is glutamine depletion. Glutamine, as you know, is important to the immune function. Glutamine also plays a role in DNA synthesis, acid-base balance, gluconeogenesis, again, tied to some of the glycogen and the glucose that we need for energy or that we need for exercise. Low plasma glutamine concentrations are reported in overtrained athletes. So again, this is one of those things that you can't really use it to predict, but once an athlete is overtrained, we know that their glutamine levels just aren't as high anymore. There's glutamine, a low serum glutamine predisposes athletes to sickness, upper respiratory infections in particular, which is again is another common symptom in overtrained athletes. So again, glutamine is also negatively impacted by poor nutrition. After you've experienced a certain trauma, and that can be emotional trauma or physical trauma, and also infections. So again, this is something that you see kind of after the fact that keeps an athlete in a state of overtraining. Theory number six is dysregulation of the hypothalamus. This is one of the weaker ones as well, but it is being purported out there. Cortisol, testosterone, as you know, other hormones are regulated by the hypothalamus and the pituitary adrenal glands and what goes on in the brain and how it functions with our hormones. The ACTH, or the androcorticotropic hormone, unfortunately, affects also the stress capacity of the individualized, the hormone response, and this also has a negative effect on circadian rhythm, which again relates to their sleep disturbances, not getting a good enough sleep, they're not recovering, they're waking up with these mood alterations, increased parasympathetic response. So they're just, again, not getting able to get that drive that they need, and this is the hormone response to that and how the hormones affect that. And then the last theory, and the one that I think is the most interesting, I put a gold star up there because it is the one that a lot of researchers and scientists are going after right now, is cytokine hypothesis. And this is what happens when we have an accumulation of stress on our bodies. Again, from physical stress and emotional stress, we kick into this immune or inflammatory response phase at micro levels, small levels, and at large levels. And what happens is instead of your body's normal response to inflammation, it has a maladaptive response to this inflammation. And it becomes accumulated, it becomes exaggerated. And I think I put in there, in the middle there, you'll see the quotation, amplified inflammation. And that's really what it is. We all are familiar with the inflammatory process and how that works and how beneficial that actually is. We've been working so long to fight inflammation that we forget that there are some benefits to inflammation. But the cytokine hypothesis, again, tells us, or it speaks to us about training at very intense levels for a very long time without adequate rest. We get this amplified inflammation, which has a sustained high level of cytokines in our bodies, in our system, in the blood, and circulating through our body, which interferes with glucose transport, decreases the amount of glycogen we can store in our bodies, decreases our hunger centers, and actually is seen as a precursor to anorexia. It also decreases the tryptophan in our blood, which is associated with increased levels of depression, and then is tied to chronic inflammation as well, and which is highly correlated with this overtraining syndrome. So this is one of the presence of cytokines is a big implication in overtraining syndrome. So these are the seven theories of why. And again, not any single one of these theories stands out as the reason. It's probably a combination and some combination of all seven. So when we think about it, we've got to look at our athletes very specifically. So some salient facts here that we need to remember about these theories is no one theory accounts for all aspects. To understand overtraining syndrome, we must take into account different aspects of each theory. The risks of OTS are positively correlated with skill level, which is one of the other things that points out some of those earlier theories I discussed, is athletes who tend to be better are more predisposed or are predisposed to a greater degree than our athletes who aren't quite as good. Our better athletes are at higher risk for overtraining syndrome. And then the main OTS catalyst, the main thing that triggers this, is actually the non-athletic stress. And I can't emphasize that enough. Okay, it's the non-athletic stress. It's the stressors that happen outside of the sport field. It's the financial stress, the exams, the relational stresses, the emotional stress. That is really the main catalyst that what throws somebody in to overtraining syndrome or non-functional overreaching. These are elite athletes in a lot of cases. Again, the higher risk for the better athletes. That's why they're typically more elite. They know how to handle the physiological stress. It's the other stuff. Throw in there now the age range that we're talking about this morning, the adolescent athlete. They have not the best capacity to understand, you know, and cognitively be aware and stress management skills that we have developed over time. So that actually compounds that as well. So let's talk now about the multi-sport or multi-season athlete and talk about exactly what that is. You can see this graph here. That I created to kind of just give you an illustration of what we're talking about with the multi-sport, multi-season athlete. You can see there your typical periodization, in-season, off-season, winter, fall, spring, the different sports that are within those seasons. This is a typical high school, okay? Again, we see this problem less and less with athletes as they get older because they start focusing on one sport and the problem becomes an off-season. In the multi-sport athlete, the issue is the overlapping of seasons. And you can see there where I put these danger zones when seasons overlap. And it's what I described to you actually earlier on when my son has football practice and baseball games going on simultaneously, and then in the middle of the day, he's got his other things that he needs to be doing. We're at increased danger zones here. Now, I want to be quick to say being a multi-sport athlete is not necessarily a huge risk factor. Some researchers will say one of the best ways to break up the monotony associated with overtraining syndrome is variety, and that is absolutely true. But that doesn't mean intensity is any less. And one of the things that's really important with these types of athletes is that we regulate their intensity. So I'm that guy, I'm that parent who goes to the football coach and says, I know this is your life right now, and you've been waiting for, you know, 4 months to get these athletes in the weight room, and intensity is everything. But don't forget, he's got a doubleheader baseball game this afternoon, and the baseball coach has already said that the performance in these games is part of the evaluation process for next year's team. So they are at high levels. He's trying to make two teams at the same time in his mind and trying to perform at a high level in both situations. He doesn't know how to handle that. And it's not just unique to my kids. This is every kid on the planet who's playing two sports or three sports. Now, I am the guy who also, sorry, son, you have to have an off season. So I'm that dad who the other dads don't get because I don't let my kid participate in winter sports, for example, because that's his off season, and we take that very seriously. But two's enough, and that's how I try to regulate that. And those are just simple recommendations I would give to you. But you can see there the overlapping in the different seasons, and some of these seasons never end. You overlap and they never end. There's soccer, then there's indoor soccer, club soccer, AAU, and all that's going on under the surface that we don't even consider while the athlete is trying out. And the issue, again, is not so much the multiple sports. I want that to be clear. The issue is the intensity that the coaches are requiring during these summer rec ball. I mean, this is summer recreation baseball season in Ohio, but there's nothing recreational or relaxing about it. It's extremely stressful. They're competing with each other. There's 30 kids on my kids' travel baseball team, and they're all vying spots on next year's varsity squad. I mean, they're like, well, they're teenagers, so you can imagine what that's like. I mean, they are competing with each other, and then the added stress of that. And throw that on top of it is my kids are homeschooled, so you've got stresses like that because they're the outcasts. They're the nerds. So that adds an element to this as well. That is that non-sport activity that is my son is very, very aware of. So this is the multi-sport athlete. Here are some of the issues with that. Recovery is lost or compromised. Non-sport stressors are typically ignored. The competition phase of one sport overlaps with the rest, or even the competition phase of another, and then peaking during playoff times, which is typically what you want to do in periodization, in a good periodization cycle, is completely lost because we're trying to peak at one time in one sport, and we're trying to ramp in another sport, and it just doesn't overlap. You can't build up one another by trying to peak performance in a different behavior. So typically we're now in an elevated state. If you remember Hans Seeley's stress response, okay, we're in that elevated sense of stress response all the time, and they're never really able to come down. It takes them several days, weeks to come down from that. And this is when we enter into that danger zone. And this is what I'm asking you. This is the second thing I'm really asking you to walk away from with this talk, is please be aware of the athletes who are competing in these multiple levels, these multiple seasons, back to back to back, where there is no real rest cycle. There's high intensity, high stress, high expectation the whole time. And don't be surprised when they start coming to you with stress fractures and shin splints and heel pain and ankle pain and hip pain and all these things. This is actually what you should expect to see when they're operating at such a high level of stress all the time. So one of the big statements, and again, walkaway points, we have to remember that they're not little adults. These multi-sport athletes in high school, for example. Now, we're not talking Bo Jacksons, guys like that, but these multi-sport athletes, they're not little adults. They don't cope the same. The way they regulate heat is completely different. The way they regulate stress is completely different. The stress that they have on their bones is different. Needs to be. We know all that, but we tend to think that they respond the same way to physiologic and emotional stress the same way a mature adult would, and they just simply do not. And that's a fact that we can't lose sight of, no matter how tough the kid really is or how skilled the kid really is. So again, this is just some quotes and some concepts that I pulled from some of the literature as I was preparing for this talk that really stand out as important points for us to remember as we're talking about the multi-sport dilemma. Often younger athletes are coaxed and cajoled by coaches and parents to train in higher intensities than are necessary. I'm not saying high intensity is bad. One of the other research areas I do is high intensity training, and I'm a big fan of high intensity training, but we have to understand high intensity training should be regulated like everything else, and it's not something always and all the time. Intensity does not have to be 100% all the time. It shouldn't. So danger zones when they are. Athletes are beginning to compete and train in multiple sports and back-to-back at younger and younger ages. Some of it's actually quite crazy. One of my colleagues at the university is a sports sociologist, and she does some very interesting research on the Tiger Woods effect, is what she kind of refers to it as, is this idea of 2 and 3 year old little athletes out there training 5 and 6 hours a day and stuff like that, and how insane that is. And the shows that you see on the cable, Little Tykes, those shows like that, some of those shows are, they glamorize the life of these children who are doing these high intensity sports with these coaches around, and that's actually creating part of this dilemma. We're seeing overtraining syndrome occur earlier and earlier. That's the alarming fact. It used to be overtraining syndrome was reserved for elite track and field athletes, distance runners, cyclists, and swimmers. It used to just be them who are at elite levels, our Olympians, our high level NCAA competitors, but now we're starting to see it occur in younger and younger athletes sooner and sooner, and that's problematic, and that's because we're starting the high-intensity stuff younger and younger. So this isn't a sociology talk, but I just wanted to throw that out there. Participating in multiple sports in and of itself is not a risk. I want to, again, make sure I make that an explicit statement. However, eliminating or reducing recovery is. Many children are competing year-round, we've said that, and then this last point I think is a salient one for us to consider as well, is in some research it's actually 75%, up to 75. Now that's a range that's huge. There's no way to quantify this with all the different data that's out there. So you'll read research that says 5% all the way up to 75. So the range is enormous, so validity there is really hard to nail down. But needless to say, upwards of 60% of pediatric sports injuries are due to training at too high of intensities too often. So again, we need to look at that. We can cut down a lot of the injuries that we're dealing with. We can cut out a lot of lost time if we could just convince our coaches more is not always better, higher intensity isn't always better. Okay, that's important. Young competitors are at greater risk because of that cognitive ability to cope with stress that I alluded to a moment ago. More training is often the first recommendation when somebody does begin to experience some non-functional overreaching, and that is, again, an important fact for us to remember. And then one of the last points I'd like to make in terms of what is being called from the literature is that overtraining syndrome is one of those things, too, that we really don't know where. I don't want to compare it to concussions, but it's similar in the fact that we kind of think overtraining syndrome is a toughness issue, or you're just not tough enough, you're just not walking it off, you're not recovering, you need to work harder, it's because you're not working hard enough, and we associate it with a toughness thing, and it's just not. It's just not an issue of being tough enough, okay? It's something else. We have to consider that with this. Some red flags that I think are important for us to look for when we're working with these athletes, whether they be junior high school, early college, is one of the biggest things you can look for and that will give you more insight than anything else is where are they at on the burnout scale? Okay, burnout is probably the best predictor we have right now. When an athlete just comes to you and they just, you know what, it's just not fun anymore. I just, you know, I'm done practicing. I just want to go to the games and that's it. I don't like the training. You know, they all will express it in a different way. And being kids, sometimes they don't know how to articulate it the best way. So we need to be vigilant and alert to these types of conversations that our athletes are having. Are they still in the locker room, in the athletic training room when they come around? Do they still have high levels of energy, or is it just kind of that mundane routine that they fall into? If you notice your athletes are there, it's a very good indicator that they're moving towards that non-functional overreaching side of the spectrum or the continuum. And we want to make sure that we give them opportunity to express what they're feeling, okay, and what they're experiencing, because rest is probably associated with that. And again, it might not be because the training's too hard. You might not have one of those coaches that's screamer and yeller and gets their heightened awareness and they're always in that fight response kind of thing, elevated. It could be something that's going on at home. It could be the fact that it's the third time, you know, of them taking their driver's ed test and they just can't seem to get past that driver's ed test or whatever it is. Those are the types of things that typically push them over. Maybe they asked, you know, somebody to the prom and they got turned down. It's those things that typically flip the switch into that non-functional overreaching because they don't have the coping mechanisms for that. So when burnout extends beyond fatigue to cause withdrawal, that from a previously enjoyable activity, that's the biggest red flag that I can tell you. There's many, I just wanted to point out that one because that's the one that has the most significant predictive value for us. Contributing factors then. What are some of the other factors that contribute to this multi-sport dilemma? Well, being an adolescent, of course, is one. Overly aggressive or ambitious parents or coaches. Coaches who lose perspective on competition, or parents for that matter, or the athlete themselves. When we start seeing a lack of an off season, a lack of recovery time, reduced or increased training load during a traditional rest or deconditioning phase, like when they're supposed to be tapering off one sport, they're ramping up for another in particular. That is one of the danger spots. And then that hyper-competitivism is really important to look at. Some other factors that we just should be aware of is coaches today are better than coaches ever have been. Coaches know more about what they're doing. They read more. Information is better. Now, we still have those coaches who aren't, but we generally, coaches have way better access to information, periodization training, skill training, all that. Because of that, practices are at those higher intensity and higher levels sooner on. And that's one of the other factors that's outside our normal peripheral vision. Equipment changes in equipment. Helmets are lighter, equipment pads are lighter, practices are at higher velocities, those kinds of things. Especially when you talk about cyclists and swimmers and even the fact they can cycle faster purely just because of some of the equipment. They can swim faster purely because some of the technology in the suits and things they wear. So these are all contributing factors as well. Think about, believe it or not, one of the highest, if you read the literature, of course, swimmers top the list at athletes who are most susceptible to overtraining syndrome. Then you come in with cyclists, but then you have golfers are high on the list And as again, you look at golf and you might think, well, this is not a super intense sport from a physical demanding standpoint, but it actually kind of is, especially when you consider the emotional aspect that goes into golf. So these are the kinds of things, sports that require high precision skill, gymnastics is another one, that are the ones that are most at risk here. And then again, gymnastics is very common in our adolescent athletes. So training loads is increasing. Media coverage of young successful athletes is a big contributing factor to this. And then the increased accessibility of sport in general are also contributing factors. Now these are generally good things. Better coaches, better training loads, getting some media coverage for your local community and the sports is going on, highly accessibility of sports. These are good things that when you combine them together can go overboard. My son, I'm using my son as a case if you haven't noticed already. He is competing, the football team, for example, are state runners-up. That's why they start, you know, in June with their conditioning, and they'll go forever. And then the baseball team is also state runners-up and district champs, and it's highly competitive, and that added stress just doesn't help. And those are the kinds of situations that we see that's going on when they're competing at high levels. The news, for example, we have a local, it's called BCSN, take off on ESPN, but a local Northwest Ohio station. They're at all the games, so their games are televised for the community. And this is just added stress that a 15-year-old is under that's really neat and really cool, but if he strikes out, it's not just mom and dad and the neighbor saw it, you know, and the other parents on the team saw it. Everybody saw it. Everybody comes out to these community games. You see everybody in the mall, everybody in the store with Perrysburg High School, you know, baseball jerseys, and it's because this is the community thing. It's like a lot of communities, and they know, oh, yeah, Nate, you struck out, man, in that critical situation, and he gets the comment in the grocery store. You know, when he's just going with mom to grab some milk, you know, that's the kind of thing that's causing overtraining syndrome to be elevated earlier on in our kids because they don't know how to cope with that. And then he's depressed again all night and can't eat dinner because he doesn't want to eat because he doesn't feel hungry now. That, and then he's still got to get up at 5 for practice the next morning for football. This is what I mean, and this is not unique to my son or my situation. This is a problem around the world, something that we need as athletic trainers to be very cognizant and aware of. So again, just some things to consider, and I'm wrapping up here. I've got only a couple more slides here. But rest may be more important than variety. One of the biggest recommendations up until the last 5 or 6 years for overtraining syndrome, and this is where evidence-based practice has really been beneficial for us as a profession, because the recommendation up until recently was always just get them playing something else to get their mind off of it. Okay, that was a good recommendation. Give them variety, the cross-training recommendation. Kind of just do something else. Get them in another sport so they can relax. That's still good advice, but what we're finding is because of these other sports are now high intensity and that multi-sport dilemma, this is not the best advice anymore. Okay, the best advice today is rest. You need to actually have an off-season. You need to actually not think about getting better at your sport for at least a few weeks every year. Because a lot, I know, for example, in my case, our off seasons, my son's already petitioning for, there's this acceleration program in town. He wants me to pay $800 to put him on this 12-week high-intensity super treadmill running because he wants to take 0.2 seconds off his 40-yard dash so he can make the high school football team, you know, so he can be in the top 10. You know, because he wants to play wide out, you know, that kind of thing. So now he wants me to do that, and that's his off season. That's off season. I'm not practicing, but it's still high intensity. He's not getting to recover and rest. He's thinking about it, consumed by it. I mean, all he does is watch videos on YouTube on how to this kind of thing, and he never lets his mind recover and rest. And this is what we really need to allow our kids the opportunity. So that just mix it up isn't necessarily the best advice anymore. Also consider the environmental factors. I didn't touch this yet, but I saved it till now. We have to consider the environmental stress that adds to all this, okay? Altitude, high temperatures, high humidity, the other issues that we are so well trained in being aware of in an emergency situation, these also just over time, a little bit at a time in small doses, has an accumulative effect as well. And then the psychosocial stressors that I've been harping on from the beginning that I think it's important for us to understand. We also have to look at that. So you look at the physical stress, the metabolic, physiological stress. You look at the emotional stress, and you look at the environmental stress. And then the fact that they're at high intensity all the time really puts these kids at risk, and they need advocates. Their parents sometimes aren't the best advocates because their parents want it worse than they do sometimes. We really are our athletes' best advocates. Athletic trainers are in the unique position to have respect in the community, influence with parents, the academic and clinical expertise to know what we're talking about. And we have that leverage with the coaches, we have the leverage with the parents, we have the leverage with the athlete. We are the perfect profession to help identify and deal with this issue. We just got to be aware of what we're looking at. And when we sit down and reasonably talk to parents or coaches like we just did, talk about, listen, there's environmental factors you're not thinking about. There's psychosocial factors that we're not thinking about. There's the physiological, metabolic factors that you're not thinking about. There's the intense, all that. A reasonably thinking person hopefully will understand what you're saying, and we can convince these athletes and coaches to allow more rest, more recovery, decrease some of the intensity. If we don't do that, the ramifications on our athletes can be severe. One of the biggest reasons we have, I'll tell you right now, I don't know that, this is me speculating, so I will give that disclaimer, but as you know, there are a lot of issues with obesity, et cetera. A lot of times, these kids who have high obesity rates and demonstrate this, started out playing certain sports, and at some point it got too much and they decided it was burnout, too much, don't want to do it, I can't do this anymore. When we don't find a replacement for them, football's it, baseball's it, basketball, soccer, whatever it is, they go out, they're just mediocre. Because they're just mediocre, they don't make teams, they think they're no good, and instead of developing a lifetime of good habits of physical activity, they say, I can't do it. And that burnout and that failure at the beginning leads to them withdrawing from a sport altogether. For those that stay in, however, and continue to do this, if they do experience overtraining syndrome or that staleness and burnout, they might quit a sport and never go back to it again just because they don't realize it was overtraining syndrome or non-functional overreaching. They just think, well, I stopped improving, so I must have met my threshold. You know, because coaches will tell everybody, you know, well, we've got this physiologic threshold, we've got this ability, and if you're good, you're going to keep getting better. That's not necessarily true. These kids go through these varying skill spikes, as it were, especially through growth spurts, and you talk about peak height velocity and all the different things that athletes go through. It changes things, and coaches will write somebody off relatively quickly because of this. Some coaches, and coaches aren't bad people. I love coaches. But they're the ones that typically are bearing the news. So we need to keep that in mind. So the ramifications is we could have athletes stepping out of sports that don't need to. And then finally, last two slides here, the recommendations. So here's the take-home recommendations. Be aware of athletes leaving one practice to report to another practice or practice that same day. Be alert to that. Be aware and watch for signs and symptoms of overtraining, okay, which is fatigue, insomnia, things like that. I actually have a list of that. We'll get to there in a minute. Be aware of how long the athlete has participated in competition phases without a break. Understand that chronological age is less important than physical maturity. Just because an athlete is 16 doesn't mean they respond the same and cope the same as another 16-year-old. Okay, that's very important. Young athletes require different amount of rest regardless of any other similarities. We need to treat especially our young athletes on a case-by-case basis. This is the hardest thing to get coaches to understand. Case-by-case basis is really important. Social-emotional factors we've covered. Be aware of that overly ambitious, hard-driving coach or parent. And then know, again, that we're not dealing with many adults. They don't cope the same way. Here's that list of signs and symptoms I was talking about. You might be overtraining if your endurance seems to be slow. You need longer times to recover. Your feet have that heavy leg feeling, athletes will say. If you start to experience lots of colds and can't fight off the sicknesses that are around the school or the office, you get restless, okay, you're not resting well. You see mood swings, high levels of irritability, maybe even some depression. Pain in muscles and joints, just achy muscles and joints that don't recover overnight. It is normal to feel achy and a little bit of pain and soreness, generally speaking, overnight, the next day, they should feel significantly better. If they're still really sore and achy the next night, outside of maybe when they first begin and you got DOMS and things like that, but generally speaking, they should be able to recover in 24 hours. If they're not feeling recovered in 24 hours, you need to start thinking non-functional overreaching. Can't sleep, can't relax, and are always anxious. They don't feel like eating, they have appetite issues, and then menstruation for our female athletes changes, either stops or becomes irregular. Okay, these are the signs and symptoms and major warning signs associated with overtraining syndrome that we need to be aware of. So I'm out of time and I'm done. This is just, we covered these, and then keys to prevention, I'll leave that up for you. I suppose we've got a minute or two for any questions or comments. There's mics up here at the front. Who wants to be the first one to get up? And
couple questions. What does rest really mean to you? Is that true rest? Is that nothing? And if so, the follow-up question to that is, what's the time period? Maybe a general, I'm sure it's different for everybody,
yep.
But what's a good off-season rest period?
Okay.
Like how long?
Great questions. What is rest? So I'm a proponent of what we call active rest. I do not mean couch potato. Okay, so couch potato is not rest. It doesn't mean do nothing at all. So rest is an active thing. Rest to me is a decrease in intensity. All right, so that's what I mean. And that's going to be, again, case by case. I think one of the biggest issues we're having with this particular arena is the case by case scenario. Because we think team all the time, and I'm all about that. Okay, but we think, well, we treat all 16-year-olds the same, and what we really need to look at is the case by case. Now, one athlete might need 2 weeks of it, one athlete might need 5 or 6 days, some might need 2 months of it, okay? You're gonna regulate that. So rest to me, how I define rest, is a significant decrease in intensity. I'm not expecting my kids, or any kids, to stop playing for 3 months, anything, and just, you know, sit around the house and relax, that kind of thing. I mean an active rest. So they're still maintaining their cardiorespiratory fitness. They might still be they're just not competing. Okay, my issue with the multi-sport dilemma is the issue that they're in a competition phase 365 days a year, and they in some aspect or another. So my idea of rest in that case is we need to have a season, an off season, where they're not in a competition phase. Okay, and they're relaxed, they're able to just play for love of the game, as it were. And that's what I mean by rest. So it's gonna be a case by case. It's a great question. Okay, so we're just decreasing the intensity. And then as far as when we are resting, how much time do we need in that lower intense phase? Again, case by case. I will tell you, though, the research says it needs to be at least 21 days. Okay, so that was, again, those first two articles that I showed you at the beginning on the PowerPoint slides. That's where that information comes from. But we're talking at least 21 days, so 3 weeks minimum. I would say, of course, and then case by case after that. So thank you. Those are great questions. Anybody else? Well, thanks a bunch. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.